Hey everybody, this is the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast. Before we get started, I wanted to take a minute to ask a quick favor from the listeners. So the point of this show is to help veterans through sharing stories like the one we're about to hear, but it can't really help if no one hears the story. So if you wouldn't mind, hit pause for a second and head on over to driveonpodcast.com/subscribe, where you can find links to subscribe to and review the show on all of your favorite podcasting apps. And if you wouldn't mind taking a second to share the podcast on social media or email or whatever, or even directly to a friend who you think might benefit by listening to the podcast, I'd really appreciate it. Today, my guest is Dave Pesserup. Dave deployed to Afghanistan in 2006 and was wounded by an IED. After the deployment, he graduated college and went on to research PTSD and traumatic brain injuries with the Department of Veteran Affairs. Dave, welcome to the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your background and everything like that?
Thanks for having me, first off.
Sure.
And yeah, I mean, I guess to put this, you know, within the confines of our conversation, to put this into context, I think we should probably start where, I was originally wounded and then sort of sure. Work our way from there. So yeah, it was 2006. And a little backstory to that, I was in my senior year of college at Roger Williams University. And sort of the apex of both the social experience and the academic experience, and like the best of the 4 years. But I'd been giving a great deal of thought to, I'd already been on one deployment, and it wasn't what I had hoped it would be. And I'd given a lot of thought, you know, a lot of thought, walking around thinking, my God, I can't believe I really haven't gone yet. And then people would find out you were in the service and they'd say, well, where have you been? And my heart would just sink. Mm-hmm. So finally, towards the end of my senior year, you know, stick out, do the senior year, graduate, or my unit was going to get deployed, and if I went and signed a waiver, it was a done deal, you were going to Afghanistan. So I didn't consult my parents. I knew that it'd be a big no from them, and I think everybody's parents would probably say a solid, hard no.
Right.
I went, I signed, came home, told them, and that was that. 6 months later or so, we're in Afghanistan. Within it, you know, I was infantry, 11 Bravo, with the 1/102nd Light Infantry. And we went in with the 10th Mountain, and then we actually ended up getting attached to Special Forces Group at this forward operation base in the Uruzgan province of Afghanistan, right near a little town called Terran Kot. After being there for some time, we went on a mission. I was in the turret of the third vehicle leaving this town, and we got hit, and I got hit. And so the whole thing was, you know, what you would imagine, pretty terrible. But a lot of good, the people we were with, the guys that were like, you know, the mid-range NCOs kept real cool heads, and they didn't make it seem half as bad. Right. I mean, their reactions were pretty cool. And even on, you know, in the position that I was in looking at it, I was like, okay, this isn't as bad as I thought. You know, they're not freaking out. You know, if the pilot's not freaking out, we shouldn't, kind of thing.
Right.
So, with the extent of my injuries, without going into, you know, sort of the deeper details of all that, ended up getting sent home. And that was tough. And so, and then begins like chapter two, right? So all your friends and all the guys that you were close with, I mean, you love them, but you hate them, but you love them. They're your unit. Now they're gone. And I was at Brooks Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas. It's a burn unit. The bigger portions of the things that I got hurt with were burns. So I ended up there. And then the whole thing sort of, it becomes trying to figure it out, trying to reconcile what just happened. Mm-hmm. And then also trying to figure out, you know, there was some confusion initially about, you know, how extensive my back injuries would be. With regard to like severity and like length of it being a problem, is this, are we looking at a lifelong thing here? So, and then, you know, the girl that I was engaged to at the time, she left me at that point. And so I was getting ready to write a blues album. This was just, it was going from worse to worse.
Right.
And just like, come on. After that, they got me to a program which allowed me to come home a little bit faster than I think other people did. Other guys were there for, you know, sitting in units, getting medical treatment, just going to appointments for like a year plus. I don't know if they do that anymore like that, but, you know, the worst thing I think you can do for mental health is just have somebody sit there and do nothing. That's not, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That seems like me, like a key ingredient to someone not feeling well. If they're already sort of, I don't know, replaying things in their head more often than not.
Right. Yeah. And so actually, through the conversations that I've had on this podcast with other people, the people who have kind of broken through the funk that they were in, that's clearly not a, you know, technical term or anything like that, but, they came to the realization that just sitting there and dwelling on things is not going to help them any. They need to do something and move on. So that's probably very similar to what you're talking about there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there could be, you know, eventually there'll be libraries of research, like a lot research that could fill libraries on that one topic of how effective that is. Ended up getting out, finished up college, and then got my first like out of the military job at the West Haven, Connecticut VA with a research group called, and the acronym is PRIME, P-R-I-M-E, and it's gorgeously complicated. It's Pain Research Informatics Medical Comorbidities Education Center, whatever.
Okay. Right.
Yeah. So I was involved as an administrative officer, like organizing and helping sort of set up studies. Not one of the scientists, though, which is an important distinction. But it's like the first move you got to make if you're like, look, I think I want to go in this direction. You know, I come from a family of clinicians. My mother's a clinician. My father's a surgeon. My sister's a nurse. My other sister's a therapist. So medicine is big in the family. And you grow up around it. You know, it's just so. So that's the first move you got to do. You got to kind of get your foot in the door. You want to work somewhere that's credible. And then I went ahead and applied to grad school. So from that sort of springboard, and I went to CCSU, and that took, I think grad school in total was like just about 5 years, and I got a master's of science in counselor education, which allows you to then become a psychotherapist, which is what I do now. And I, now I'm in private practice, and I've been in private practice for 3 years. And yeah, so, and all of these, you know, the trajectory of being a patient and then like going to the other side of the coin and taking care of the patient, there are, you know, you're constantly reminded of how impressively similar you are, even if you're better now. You can be like, oh, yeah, I remember what that looked like. Sure, sure. Now, not all of it, but, you know, I think it really does allow you to better serve those that you're working with, because you can, if not recognize, completely understand, like, where they're coming from when it comes to, especially the major mental health stuff, like major depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and just dealing with like all of the comorbidities that come with like trauma. And comorbidities, I guess, could more easily be said as like all of the different other issues that can come out than just the ones you think would be obvious. So, yeah. And as a therapist, the therapy that I do, the one that I hang my hat on, is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is very, very sort of like linear and logical. And what's great about it is if you really do have something to worry about, it'll say you should start worrying. Whereas if you have nothing, you come up with nothing. It's an excellent way, in short, to sort of cross-examine like very chaotic or catastrophic thoughts.
Okay.
And then people, especially guys, they like that. And I tell people in session, I say, look, you know, if you got something to worry about, like, I'll tell you. I'll tell you right now. But, like, if you don't, like, you don't. Right? So, yeah. And one other sort of side piece to this, and then I'll kind of slow down here, which I also think is another really important contextual factor, is when I came home, my parents being clinicians took one look at me and they're like, look, physically you're kind of getting there, but like, we're worried about you. So here's the deal. You got to go see somebody. Mm-hmm. So I started seeing somebody in New Haven, and I had gone through a bunch of different mental health professionals, and I thought, like, you know, oh, this is sort of disingenuous, or people are just fabricating in their mind a feel-good moment, but when they leave, there's really no practical application. Those sorts of things, right? Where you're just like, come on, this just is not for me, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't want to sit in here and bang and drum and light some incense. I'm not feeling it. Like, either we fix the problem or we don't. Right. And I ran into this guy who was ferociously intelligent and had a background in philosophy in undergrad. And I mean, the guy was just an all-star. And he happened to be like a pretty alpha guy, which was not what I had encountered yet. Mm-hmm. I thought, huh, everything this guy is saying is making sense. And he was a cognitive behavioral therapist. And that's really like... I would say that was the one thing I could say takes the lion's share for me being where I am today, is to be able to go through that therapy and walk away and go, you know what? Not only does it work, I'm going to go do it.
Right. Yeah. And that seems to make a ton of sense too. You know, you've seen it work firsthand. You've experienced the benefits of it, and, you know, why not make that available to more people through the work that you do now? You know, that just, to me, it makes a ton of sense. You know, it's like someone who, you know, does yoga or something, and they lose a bunch of weight or whatever, and they're like, you know what, this is amazing. Let's go, you know, learn how to be a yoga instructor and teach more people or something like that. You know, it seems to make sense that you would follow along in a path like that, you know, to get to, you know, obviously where you are today. Now, the people that you work with, are they vets, or is it more, you know, generalized, or a mix of, you know, people that you work with now?
So, the, private practice that I work with is general practice. And so okay. I would say like a third of my patients are adolescents and two thirds are adults.
Okay.
It's sort of, what would be a presentation of like a smattering of the public. So nothing too exotic as far as mental health issues, but certainly not veteran issues. It's not something that I'm not going to, you know, eventually move closer to, but this is where I am right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. And I think it's important too. You know, some of the people have issues that might mirror some of the traumas that come through war, you know, some of the traumas that you experience and that many other, you know, soldiers that have experienced through war, you know, whether it's, you know, car crashes or, you know, some other abuses or things like that. You know, some of those traumas could probably mirror, some of the things that soldiers, you know, have experienced as well. You know, so it's important to help obviously everybody, you know, in a practice like yours that makes a ton of sense to be able to, you know, help out the general, you know, population too, and not just focus on, you know, any one subset of the population. So you talked about your experience going through, you know, therapy and going to, you know, a couple, people who just didn't seem to quite get it. What was that experience like? Because I know I've talked to a few people before who said that they tried out, you know, they went to a counselor and they didn't seem like they were a good fit, and they felt like they just wanted to throw their hands up in the air and quit on the therapy that they were doing, because it just didn't seem like it was working. What was your experience like with that?
Sounds similar to what you just described.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So It just either it'd be a one of a couple factors. So one, you'd sit down, you'd look at this person, you go, no shot. This isn't somebody I'd share 10 minutes with outside, you know, smoking a cigarette, let alone anything deep. And I guess that's sort of judging a book by its cover, but you're just like, this isn't going to happen. And then there'd be another one that, well, their approach would be like abrasive, or like, it just, it wasn't right. I guess you could kind of, this is going to really simplify this, and I don't know if it should be simplified at this point, but it's kind of like Goldilocks. You know, this one's too cold, this one's too, one of these things.
Yeah.
But more serious, but it's got to be the right fit. And yeah. And then there were a few of them that almost seemed like, you know, they were upset, or they got some sort of shift they weren't pumped about. And you're like, look, I'm not that pumped to be here either. So I guess.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think the VA is a really, really, you know, it's a big organization, and they're trying to get this stuff right. But, you know, this is back in 06, 07. You know, I wasn't impressed. Mm-hmm. And thank God I come from a background where my parents could say, look, you got to go. We'll help. Let's go. But yeah, I guess I'm not giving you as many details, I think, as you'd like, as to the particulars of why or why not. It's been a little bit of time, but you know that expression, you don't remember what they said to you, but you remember how they made you feel?
Yep.
Yeah. And I don't remember the particulars, but I remember walking out of there and being like, what in the world is this?
Yeah.
What's going on? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that does make sense. You know, I know from my own personal experience, you know, I happened to get lucky on the first go. The first person I went to and talked to, was, we kind of just hit it off, and you know, he was able to help me out and, you know, work through, you know, some issues and stuff after I came back. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful for, you know, all the stuff, but I think, you know, just because I happen to have that good experience where I, you know, found somebody right away that was able to help me. And that not only were they able to help me, they cared enough to be able to help. And, not to say that the other people don't care, but you know, there's varying degrees of, the level of service that you're going to get in any kind of industry that you're talking about. You know, the same thing in the mental health industry. You're going to have some people who are rock stars and some people who, you know, are kind of just barely scraping by, and you're going to get the whole range there. So you have to kind of keep an open mind and not just give up on it because that first person you went to didn't work out. You know, like what happened with you, and you went to somebody else and somebody else, and, you know, eventually you found that person who resonated with you and you really clicked. And I think that's important for people to take away. And understand is that if you need to talk to somebody, you need to talk to somebody regardless of whether the fact that first person that you talked to was the right person. You're still going to need to talk to somebody the next day or the next week or whatever. And so you can't just give up. You know, maybe that person's not right, but you know, try somebody else. You know, move on from that one person.
You know, when I do my intakes, this is such a thing. I mention it. In my intake, I get right around the middle. I go, hey, and by the way, just so you know, like, this is an interview for you too. Like, you're checking me out. I was like, and if you walk out of here and you think no shot, I'm like, don't worry about it. My feelings aren't hurt. In fact, let me know. I'll help you find someone else.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I'm like, so don't worry about me. Like, this is all about you. And if this isn't right, maybe I'll remind you of someone that you freaking hate. Don't worry about it. I'll help you find someone else. Just let me know.
Yeah. And that's, I'm glad that you do things like that. And, you know, I'm sure there's others out there who do similar things too, but, you know, that's really important, I think, to make sure that they feel comfortable talking to you, because if they don't feel comfortable, they're not going to talk about, they're not going to give you that deep dive into their background and the issues that they're experiencing. Cause I mean, those are deeply personal things that they're going to be talking about, you know, most likely. And if they are not feeling comfortable, that they're just not going to open up the way you're going to need them to. The other thing that you mentioned, and I thought was really interesting, was how your parents kind of observed some issues that were kind of going on with you and said, you know, physically seems like you're heading in the right direction. You're getting back to where you need to be. But maybe mentally you need a little bit of help. And I think that is a huge thing to have, is that the support of family or, some sort of support network, whether it's family, you know, not everybody has family around that's going to be able to, point that stuff out, but friends, family, neighbors, coworkers, things like that, people who are able to, point those things out and feel comfortable enough bringing them up to you. Is that something that you see with your patients, that the people who come to you is like, my wife told me that I haven't been acting right, or whatever, and that's why I'm here, or my parents or whoever. Is that something that you typically see, or is it more kind of like self-diagnosis, like, hey, I'm just not feeling right?
No, I do see quite a few people come in with reports from like their close family saying, look, something's different. Mm-hmm. So could you be more specific and hear X, Y, and Z? Okay. And those, anybody who sort of closely orbits that person is like a real asset in trying to understand the behavior of that person. So they're there. You say, yeah. So, you've been with him for his whole life. What's going on? Well, now he's this, that, and the other. And you would know it in such a way that someone who potentially, I don't know, orbit again is the right word, but someone who's one or two more rungs removed may not be close enough to see. And so like they're truly an asset to lean on and to talk to as much as possible if the patient lets you.
Yeah, that's really good. And do you incorporate those other people into your sessions when you talk to people, or is it, or do you just kind of like rely on the fact that they kind of gave them that nudge to start seeing you?
It's case specific. And when it's like, when determined that it would be beneficial, absolutely. But then sometimes for the kids, for adolescents, you don't want to set up a scenario where you look like an additional parent.
Right.
You have the parent there, the kids there, I'm there. And now we're talking about, well, hey, the window got broken and we're kind of looking into it. What's up? And I might look like the other parent. So I don't like to bring in, parents for that stuff. Cause you want to remain like clinical neutrality. You're there for them. Mm-hmm. And like, that's it. You advocate for them. So for adults, yeah, you can bring the family in sometimes, especially around substance abuse.
Okay.
You want to have some confrontation around that. You're like, look, bud, I know maybe you're misremembering, maybe, but mom's here and she's saying that there's a lot around that's going disappearing around the house. And you're saying you don't know what I'm talking about. So how do we reconcile the two? And for something like that, you would certainly need both parties in the room. And it wouldn't be like a cross-examination. This is simply just, I guess a case of whodunit. But,
sure.
But
yeah. Yeah, in a lot of cases, but sometimes they need to, hear that from multiple angles to kind of come to that come to be able to admit it on their own, sometimes. So that's probably good to have that outside force. But I know through talking to other people that the family and those other relationships, those people, like you said, who are kind of like in that inner circle, the people who are closest to the individual are extremely beneficial to being able to point out, when things seem like they're not going right. And I think from a mental health perspective, and I'm not a therapist or counselor, I'm not trained in any of this at all. But I would think having those relationships, any sort of close relationships. Maybe you don't have a great family relationship with your parents or your siblings or whatever. But if you have close relationships with somebody, who is going to be willing to call you out when it seems like there's an issue, and help you get the help that you need, I think ultimately has been beneficial. And I know the reason why I'm bringing this up is because I know that there are some people who kind of push other people away when they start to question, you know, how are you feeling? How are you doing? All all those types of questions, they start to push those people away because they don't really want to face those issues. But by facing them, they are ultimately going to get better. Hopefully going to get better. And I don't see there being any downside to facing these issues necessarily. I could be wrong, with some of that, but I think my point is having those close relationships is a good thing. And if you're listening to this and you're one of those people who feel like you need to push people away because they're questioning, how you're doing and everything, I think you need to kind of reevaluate that a bit and, embrace some of those relationships. I don't know. Hopefully I'm not leading people in the wrong direction. I'll let the person who's maybe a little more qualified to talk about that, confirm or, talk a little bit more about that.
I applaud the pointing this out, and I would highlight it. Look, if you're already starting to be in isolationist behavior, it's like, boom, the first light goes off. It's like, all right, fine. Look, something's up. And as a friend, I think like we, because we love the person and because there's an intimacy between friends. Certainly like you also want to know what's up and how can you help. And I think as beautiful as a sentiment that is, I would caution and probably just say like as the friend, like, look, I'm not the counselor. So like, we probably like, let's not you and I hash it all out. What I will do as the friend is get you to go to somebody. Like, mm-hmm. You don't gotta like, don't play the therapist. Just be like, look, clearly you don't feel well. You don't gotta say anything to me. Let's just go though. I'll take you or whatever. Or like, right. let's keep talking about like, this is a possibility. Let's like shop some people out. Because that can make things tough for someone too, who's trying to play there's a role there, and I think appropriately it's the friend trying to get you help, not the friend trying to be the help. And I think there's a major distinction. And one is very like wholly unqualified. And even if you are qualified, it's still like sometimes like, whoa, I'm not sure here. Like the right answer is not readily available. What is this?
Right. Yeah. And you might be too close to the situation too. And you might have, some blinders on, and especially if like you're saying, if you are qualified, it may not be the best, you may not be the best person to talk to this person. So, so that does make some sense. So I'm glad you confirmed that. Not that I need the ego boost that I was right or anything like that to mention that, but glad that I'm glad that it made sense to somebody who does know what they're talking about and not just, some guy who runs a podcast.
You're right on the button.
Yeah, good. So what other kind of advice would you give to, let's just say, a vet, somebody comes back from Afghanistan, Iraq, wherever they're at, and they come back and they're having some issues, whether it's at home or with, drinking or drugs or, whatever. What kind of advice, outside of just go talk to somebody, what kind of advice would you have to give to them, about that?
Well, okay. So first, what I would say is, of course, you got to start seeing somebody, sure. But that's not enough. There's got to be a few other things here. And one thing that I was always impressed by, I worked at a rehab facility for a certain of my clinicals for 2 years. And I ran, I did a lot of group work. And you'd get guys in for individual one-on-one therapy. And look, you may have a great 55 minutes and sometimes you didn't. You put 15 guys in a room with the same issue. And then you run the group and then you kind of back off. They became 8 out of 10 times a stronger change agent for each other than I did standing there and talking to them with a whiteboard. So when I think of guys coming home, I'd say, look, go get in a group. Even if there's some old-timer Vietnam vets and stuff like that, there's still going to be some parallels. You want to be around guys that are similar so that you're not walking around thinking, I'm going crazy. I'm the only guy out here, because you're not. And those guys are such a strong change agent for each other, much more effective than one-on-one therapy, and augment it with one-on-one therapy if you can, and you should. And then in addition to that, I mean, that's if it's something more serious than if there's lethality involved in it, then I'd say you want to go inpatient and you want to have your friends and family push you to that, if that's where it goes to. And if it goes there, by the way, it's not good. It's not bad. No, it's not ethical. It's not unethical. It's just the appropriate treatment for the problem. Just like a big, you know, big wound requires stitches, or diabetics have to take a med. Like, it's not a, there's so much stigma wrapped around these, like, oh, well, I don't want to get help like that, because don't worry about it. It's just the right, it's what the doctor ordered for that. That's it.
Right.
I wouldn't spin your wheels thinking about what's this mean about me. Nothing. It just means like the appropriate dosage for the appropriate issue, period.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that group setting that you were talking about earlier is really good too. And I think for partially for the same reasons that we were talking about, you know, not to push people away and things like that, is you have a group of people that, you know, perhaps are like-minded, or, you know, at least going through the same issues or similar issues, I should say. And that helps people kind of know that they're not alone in whatever issues that they're struggling with. What would you say about, now, not necessarily from a, you know, therapy standpoint, but so you get out of the military, you know, you're used to, you know, the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years or whatever, you were in the military, you're used to spending time with, you know, bunch of other grunts or, you know, whatever, you know, in the military. And then you all of a sudden you get out and now you're living civilian life. You're working a civilian job. You're going to civilian stores. You know, you're not going to the PX or whatever on base or whatever. You're in civilian life. What would you think in terms of like joining a veteran organization like the VFW or American Legion or, you know, things like that, in terms of that camaraderie that you have, you know, do you think that might help boost, or at least make it a little bit easier to kind of transition into civilian life, you know, being a part of a group of other like-minded kind of individuals?
Unequivocally. Yes.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. And for I think echoing a lot of the reasons for just saying for the group as well. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, we actually had a someone from the VFW on the show a couple of weeks ago, and you know, we're sort of talking a little bit about that, you know, people getting out and having that struggle of, you know, like just jumping right into civilian life, even though we all were civilians at one point, we kind of get rewired a little bit in the military, and we don't think like civilians anymore. And so, you know, so getting back into, you know, a group of people who are, you know, like-minded, you know, in one of those, you know, veteran type organizations, it just to me makes sense, you know, to feel like that you still have that connection with people. You know, who are like-minded. So I have we're kind of coming up on time here and as far as the length of the episode here, but I have one last question that I like to ask everybody, you know, before kind of wrapping up. And that question is, so before you joined the military, is there anything that you wish someone would have told you, either about what the experience would have been like, or what to expect at, you know, in a combat environment? And you can answer this seriously or with a joke, combination of the two, doesn't matter. There's no wrong answer. You know, we've had all sorts of answers to this question. So, you know, is there anything that you wish someone would have told you before you joined?
That's a good question. Oh boy. I have nothing clever, or I have no real estate. I mean, other than, you know, my estimation of how difficult it could be was like woefully low.
Yeah.
I was like, I didn't realize it could be like as tough as it was. But here's what I wish someone had told me. You're about to get an education for which there is no tuition.
Yeah, that is very true. There is, as a matter of fact, you get paid to go get this education.
Yeah, it's like a Thunderdome for college tuition.
Yeah. And I actually remember in basic training sitting there on the 50 cal range, you know, kind of letting it rip and thinking to myself, they're actually paying me to do this. This is amazing. You know.
Exactly.
So, all right. Any last things that you want to add that maybe we didn't talk about, or, you know, anything, any way that people might be able to get in touch with you if they want more information, or anything like that?
No, I mean, that's pretty much it on my end. I want to thanks a million for having me on. This is a lot of fun. I was a little nervous, wasn't sure I was going to go, but,
I'm glad you did.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you. Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com, or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.